Good afternoon, everyone. It's Tuesday. Anybody awake out there? Thank you. There you go. Come on. It's not Friday, and we don't even have Friday. They gave up on Fridays at Tech Ed. Why? Because no one came to the sessions. You guys were all partied out, tired, had enough. So now I'm just going to let you have the party and then go home. Okay, so now I haven't told anybody, so if you told your boss you're here all week, that's okay, right? You're good to go. So welcome to the Busy Developer's Guide to Virtualization. My name is Brian Randall. I'm a senior consultant with MCW Technologies. And this whole session is all about making you hopefully love and appreciate virtualization the way I do. I think it's fantastic and wonderful. And before I get into the slides, one of the things I was talking about with someone earlier was, well, you can't do this in virtualization. And the word can't is really a bad word when you tell it to a developer. And the good news is that the Microsoft developers working on the technology that we're going to talk about have really improved the technology to where if you've tried virtualization in the past and walked away from it and said, it won't work for me, you need to reconsider it. You can do just about anything today. How many of you went to Monday's keynote and saw Jeff Woolsey talk about Hyper-V? Now, what was great about that, and you know, Jeff did a great job, and he talked more about the server side of Hyper-V and how it affects IT pros and the people running the data centers. But all that goodness that's in there is the core engine about what we're going to talk about. I'm going to talk about both using the server and the client as a developer. And what's great about that is all the investments they've made in performance and scalability. You know, crazy numbers like 64 terabyte virtual hard drives, a terabyte of RAM inside a virtual machine, to the point that, you know, they're basically saying they can run just about every possible SQL server load in a virtual machine when properly configured. So one of the things I hear a lot, too, is, you know, running Visual Studio is a bit of a pig when running under a virtual machine. So this is a Windows 7 virtual machine running on Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1 Hyper-V. And this is a high-definition 720p video. And you'll notice the frame rate. And we'll go full screen. Now, if you watch this video on your machine, you notice the shake is from the camera. It's not the video, right? Look how smooth that is. I got no drop rates in my sound. Okay? Looks pretty darn good to me. Right? Now, the reason this works is because of a technology called RemoteFX. I'm going to touch on it in my talk, give you some details. The session before me actually went into gory detail about a bunch of the new enhancements coming in the next release. So you should really watch VIR313 if you think this RemoteFX stuff looks interesting to you. So that was a high-def video, but you guys are developers. So one of the things that you might care about is getting better performance out of Visual Studio. Now, this is Visual Studio 2010 Ultimate Edition, but this applies to all the 2010 releases as well as the 2012 releases. Remember, in the 2010 release of Visual Studio, Microsoft made this, and we'll just skip signing in to TFS. They made this a WPF application, right? The shell is now written in WPF. That meant they could do some great visualization stuff and make it look all pretty. We still have color in the 2010 version. One of the things they did is, you know, WPF is designed to take advantage of your nice GPU. Now, if I go to Tools Options, there's a setting here for automatically adjust visual experience based upon client performance. Now, go home and try this in a VM without RemoteFX, or I'll show you later. If I uncheck this, you'll notice there's an Enable Rich Client Visual, but notice this, use hardware acceleration if available. I'm inside a virtual machine, and it thinks I have hardware acceleration. That's pretty darn slick. So I can come in here and open up or do something, do a new project. And we'll do a new, like say a WPF app. And I've given this only 4 gig of RAM and all that stuff, but there you go. There's the designer. Right, all the stuff you'd expect is all gonna work and you're gonna get a nice experience that you might not normally get, et cetera. Okay, so this is really good stuff. So let's go back and I'll tell you a little bit about the different features and what we're going to talk about in here. Now, when we think about what's going on with virtualization, right, virtualization is quite dynamic. Well, how does this affect developers? Well, with developers, right, we're seeing tons of growth in demand. Right, people talk about the economy, and it's interesting because people say, well, how are you doing? I got more work than I can do. Being in IT and doing development right now, there's more work for good developers than there isn't. I mean, you can stay employed if you want to. Now, sometimes the apps aren't great, right? You know, accounting apps aren't always sexy, right? Some people would like to be building the latest, greatest consumer game or something. But the growth is there. Innovation is happening constantly in development. And doing development by yourself is really generally not that much fun, right? Team development is really where it's at, being able to build really cool, compelling solutions for our customers. And then we have this whole idea of the cloud, where I can put some of my systems up there on the internet, constantly available, with high availability, and all those great things that the cloud provides. So when I think about virtualization, what makes me excited, I think about this is really a complex world full of technology. And I love playing with all this stuff. I can't help myself. Ever since I got into development, I wanted to play with everything. And that's, unfortunately, a little bit of a problem, right? Because it means I didn't have a social life for a while. Luckily, I found a woman who loved me, and I was able to get married and have kids. But the fundamental problem is I love all this software. I think it's cool, and I want to play with it. But my hardware budget only goes so far, right? I've gotten a little older. I make a little more money, so maybe I can get a few more toys occasionally. But still, there's more things I want to try than I have a chance to do. And then there's this whole issue of our new cycle. Have you noticed now that just about everything seems to be in beta forever, right? I mean, Google really set the trend, I think, when they did Gmail, and it was in beta for, what, 6 years? I don't know, some crazy period of time. It was in beta forever, right? And Microsoft now, being very agile, right? You've got, you know, the Windows team and Office teams are still a bit slower, and even Visual Studio's, you know, starting to branch out. But now we're seeing new releases of this, that, and the other thing. You know, we ran into a developer friend of ours. I was talking to a buddy of mine. And this other developer was having trouble with the beta of Visual Studio 2012. And we're like, well, what do you got on your machine? Let's take a look. And the amount of stuff she had on the machine was ridiculous because the developer swore that they needed all the stuff. They had Visual Studio 2008, 2010, and the beta, you know, two copies of Office and everything. And it's like, have you not heard of virtualization? Your life could be so much better if you just isolated that stuff and used it when you needed it. But this person was afraid of it. It's like, well, I don't understand it. I don't have time. I'm too busy. It's not that hard, folks, right? It's gotten a lot better. So we start thinking about what we're going to do. We start thinking about virtualization providing the flexibility for you as a developer, right? So you have the ability to run beta applications. You get the ability to try new things out without messing with things. You can apply a service pack and use snapshots, and if it works, you can commit the snapshot and merge it with your image. If it doesn't work, things start going crazy, you throw it away. Right? The ability to try different configurations of your application, right? More or less RAM. Testing the latest features that are coming from Microsoft in a pre-release package of the SDKs. All those things are available to you as a developer. And this is just using stuff that's being handed to you, things that's being written for you. What about the stuff that you're writing? Right? Developers have the nasty syndrome of, well, it worked on my machine. Well, of course it did. You installed the full SDK. You installed a bunch of DLLs into the GAC that you forgot about. You downloaded this extra third-party library that you forgot about. With a clean virtual machine that you can constantly roll back, it just takes a few seconds to open up a connection, drop some files in there, even enable remote debugging, and you're good to go. So it's that type of flexibility that gives you more choice in the way you manage your process. Now, what I'm going to talk about is what do you need to do virtualization. I'm talking about the hardware and software, and I'll talk about my configurations here and things that I've learned to make my life better. We'll talk about working with virtual machines. Specifically, we're going to talk about Hyper-V. And then we'll look at optimizations you can do and tips and tricks that I've learned over the years to just make your life a little better. Now, just some quick vocabulary to make sure we're on the same page. First of all, virtual machine, right? This is a quote from Wikipedia, right? It's a completely isolated guest operating system installation with a normal host operating system, right? The key thing to understand about a virtual machine, when you get past all the configuration, once it's running, it is a Windows machine or a Linux machine or whatever you're running. That means it needs to be cared for and fed just like any other operating system you have. That means things like Windows updates. It means possibly antivirus. That's something you're going to do if you're going to be connected to a network. Right? It's just another machine. Now, the fact that it can be self-contained and made portable and you have the flexibility to run on different hosts, that's the benefits of virtualization. But just remember, the virtual machine still has all those things that relate to physical computers that you have to deal with. Now, the host is the physical computer. So I have three host machines here today running Windows 8 Release Preview, Windows Server 2012 Release Candidate, and Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1. Right, so I have three host machines, and on them, I have any number of guest machines that I'll be talking about and showing you different types of operations that we can do. And while I'm talking, I'm starting up additional virtual machines. How exciting is that? All right. Now, in the guest, a guest is a virtual machine running on top of a host. And we just make sure we have that different nomenclature so we can talk about different things that need to be done. Now, there's different types of virtualization out there. We're going to focus on operating system virtualization, and we'll talk a little bit about device virtualization. There's also this notion of application presentation virtualization. And the downside to this is that because virtualization has gotten richer, it's often hard to find things with your favorite search engine. Right? Sometimes you go type something in, and first of all, you deal with all the spam and the site squatters. But then you can't just type virtualization, right? That's not good enough, right? So you have to be more specific about what you're looking for. And once again, we're going to focus on primarily operating system stuff. Now, Microsoft has a number of virtualization technologies across those four major categories. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about Hyper-V specifically. I'm going to focus on Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. But most of what I talk about applies to the previous releases. I'm also going to talk about something called Boot to VHD, which is device virtualization. There's a little magic in what's known as the bootloader that will let you use a VHD as the boot device off of your host machine. And it means you can do a number of cool things, one of which is that I am actually using Boot to VHD on all three of these machines. Yet I'm also running a hypervisor, which is the Hyper-V technology, on top of it. So this is really cool, compelling stuff. So we're going to talk about that also. The other stuff, no. AppV is a completely different solution to a completely different problem. Remote desktop services, while we will use RDP and we take advantage of it, and there's some crossover with a technology called RemoteFX. I'm not going to spend time on there. And then virtual PC, virtual server, Windows virtual PC. These are legacy virtualization technologies. And reasons why you won't use them, number one, they don't let you run x64 virtual machines. They're x86 only. They're all uniprocessor, so they will only present one virtual processor to the guest operating system. Okay? And number three, they're just outdated. They're not getting love from Microsoft. Microsoft's not investing in them anymore. Now, that said, yes, you've got, for example, a machine that is not capable of running Hyper-V and you still want to be able to run a virtual machine, go for it. A lot of the principles I'll talk about apply, particularly when it comes to the hardware. But these definitely are not bleeding edge. And in fact, these things kind of Microsoft let fade it out as they moved on to Hyper-V. And so there are alternatives like VirtualBox and VMware. So Hyper-V is Microsoft's enterprise-class hypervisor. What's a hypervisor? A hypervisor is just this thin piece of software that sits between the real metal on your machine and this set of guest operating systems that you run. Now, there's different ways to set up a hypervisor. There's also this notion of what are called host-based hypervisors, which is what virtual server was. And then you have Hyper-V and things like VMware's vSphere or ESX server, which are thin hypervisors, very thin piece of software that manages the virtualization stack and then presents features that allow virtual machines to be executed and managed. Now, the way Windows has approached this is that, depending upon the version of Windows you run, you can have what's called a parent partition. And that parent partition presents the standard features of Windows to you. This is what you get, for example, on these two machines. I'm running, well, actually all three, but Windows Server, in both cases, there's the hardware, there's the hypervisor, and then I'm running a full copy of Windows with the GUI and everything else. Now, you also can get Windows Server Core. And Windows Server Core has a very thin, pared-down version of Windows, but there's still a bit of a GUI there. And then they have something called Hyper-V Server. Hyper-V Server only has a console-based interface, and it's morally equivalent to ESX server from VMware in that it's completely bereft of a nice GUI or anything. Right? It's all command line, et cetera. And the interesting thing about that is that that's completely free. You still have to pay for the licenses for your Windows boxes you run on it, but it doesn't have any additional overhead charge, whereas if you want to run Hyper-V on these major copies of Windows, you have to have the appropriate server license. By the way, licensing I will not go into. If you have questions, you can talk to me after the session, send me an email, or we'll find a Microsoft person to talk to you about it. But licensing just is that unhappy place to go. To run Hyper-V, you need a 64-bit host operating system to run it on. So that means Windows Server 2008 x64, because there is a 32-bit version. And then starting with 2008 R2, Microsoft no longer makes a 32-bit version of the server. Okay? Now, with Windows Server 2008 R2, you really want to have SP1, because that's where they added dynamic memory as well as RemoteFX, or Windows Server 2012. Now, Windows Server 2012 provides that magical third release. I mean, they really just have hit it out of the park as far as Hyper-V features. Like I said, Jeff Woolsey from the keynote, you should just rewatch that section because he just hammers it home. And there's a bunch of great sessions here at TechEd on that. Once again, more IT pro focused. But if you're really thinking, for example, about running a ton of VMs in your test environment, et cetera, you should really look at that. Now, the cool thing, though, for professionals and developers is that we now have Hyper-V on the client, which means you get all the great Windows stuff that we want, our media player and desktop experience and stuff without having to do a bunch of jumping through hoops. Now, you'll notice what's interesting. If I go back to the machine I showed you a second ago with RemoteFX, this is the VM. If I minimize this, you'll notice, though, I still have glass, a start screen. You look at all this stuff. And that's because I went out of my way to make the server. And if we go in here, go to properties. And this is Server 2008 R2 Enterprise. I went on my way to make it look like Windows 7. I put down the desktop experience. I installed my nice video driver. I installed my sound card, et cetera. So you could make Windows work fairly well, but it's still not Windows 7, and certain programs just will not run. And plus, if you're a gamer, it's kind of frustrating. And granted, I do this for a living. A lot of other people are like, look, Brian, yeah, I think it's cool that you can do all that, but I just want to carry one machine, one copy of Windows, and just live my lifestyle. So you'll find that Windows 8 on the client provides that, and that's really nice. Now, so you can do Hyper-V on your client, and Hyper-V on the client doesn't have any core limitations. For example, they didn't say you can only have VMs that are 32 gigs of RAM. The core Hyper-V engine is the same as the server. It's just additional features might not be there. One of those cool features is, for example, is Hyper-V replica. That's only available when you run the server version. But on the client, you can have giant VMs, use gobs of RAM, you know, 64-bit, tons of cores, whatever works, you can do that on your client. So it's not limited in any way in that regard. Now, we think about hardware. This is where people make the mistake, and they complain about virtualization. Oh, virtual machines are always slow. Well, sure they are. Right? When you're running a bunch of other crap on top of the machine is underpowered in the first place, and you're just getting by on the real metal, you can't add a whole other machine. Remember, just because it's virtual doesn't mean it doesn't have all those requirements of a real machine. Yeah, it's going to be slow. Particularly when you think you can do, oh, run Outlook, run Visual Studio, and then run a whole other virtual machine, and you've got, you know, 3 gigs of RAM. And you've got a hard drive that's maybe 100 gigs, and it's a 5400 RPM laptop drive. Yeah, it's going to be a bad experience. If you can't invest in reasonable hardware, right, you're going to have a bad experience. So we're going to talk about these five areas. Now, the first one that's important is processor support. Now, the good news is that the first requirement for Intel VT or AMD V, aka Vanderpool or Pacifica, is that all the modern processors have this. Now, there was a weird period of time where certain manufacturers, Dell, were selling machines where they would disable the ability to turn this on. The processor that you bought from Intel supported it, but they would lock it out in the BIOS. The reason I know that is because I bought one. I was a very unhappy camper. Okay? These days, you won't find it in the new processor. It's just there, okay? So all definitely, if you're buying Sandy Bridge or Ivy Bridge, you're good to go. There's no problem there. It'll be there. But you go all the way back to things like your Core 2 Duos, right? Around 2006, 2005, you're good. Okay. Now, you're going to find a lot of extra stuff in the BIOS. Now, there's a little problem in trying to show you BIOS and be on the screen at the same time. So we won't go there. But I'm sure some of you have looked in there because you need to turn this on sometimes. Depending on the type of computer you get, you need to turn it on. And it's generally labeled as enable hardware virtualization. Now, sometimes you'll see Intel VT depending upon the BIOS. And then you also see things like Intel VT-D or Intel VTX, all sorts of enhancements. Right now, for Hyper-V, none of those things are really taken advantage of. And so unless you have specialized hardware from your manufacturer, particularly on the server side, right, where you have specialized, you know, multi-port network adapters or fiber channel plugs or all sorts of things. Unless you have something special, they've told you to enable it. But unlike most of your laptops, just leave it off. Hyper-V itself will not do anything with it. And in certain weird edge cases, it actually can cause things not to load correctly. Okay? You just need the Intel VT. Now, when you think about cores and sockets and everything, everything is presented to your virtual machine just as a virtual processor. Okay? Now, the processor numbers have gotten crazy, right? I don't even know what the final magic number is, but you know, right now they don't have a limit as to what they will show based upon the host. The host has a physical limit that Hyper-V will see. And it's like, I don't know, 320, 160, I don't know, some crazy number of cores or virtual processors. Now there's three levels we go. We have sockets, cores, and within cores we can have hyper-threaded cores. Okay? So, for example, if we go over here to my Windows 8 machine, and we go to Task Manager, and we go to the Performance tab and look at CPU, and we want to change graph to Logical Processors, right? I have one socket in here, And then I have four cores, and those are hyper-threaded cores, so Windows sees it as 8 logical processors. When you're doing your math as to what your machine cares about, you care about logical processors, and then you think about when you're trying to push your limits on things like heavy load or lots of machines on the same machine, then you really start to go, well, you know, hyper-threaded cores aren't the same as a full core, so you can kind of break those in half. And in fact, sometimes when you get one of the really modern new machines and they have too many, you would turn off hyper-threading because it would present half to the server. Hyper-V in 2012 does not have that problem, so it'll be up to you. The point is, you think of these, for all intents and purposes, in most workloads, as you would a processor. So if you typically like having four cores for your laptop machine, that's going to be good for a Windows client. For your server, yeah, give them as much as you can relative to the shared workload. Right, for developers, we often typically just running one or two extra virtual machines that we want to do some work on, so just split the workload evenly. But you want to look at this. Now, one thing about your CPU that's important is something that's called SLAT, or single-level address translation. Now, Intel and AMD call it different things. Intel calls it extended page tables. Now, what it just basically means is the following. When the hypervisor is doing things between the real hardware and the virtual machines, they're having to translate virtual addresses and virtual operations to the real hardware, right? And they've got to orchestrate all those operations. Now, one of the things we've talked about is that we have client-side Hyper-V. That means I have a Windows machine that's running Windows Metro, has a high-performance video card in here, and does all these great things. Well, it turns out that the way this information gets presented to the physical machine through the hypervisor can cause what are called page faults. It basically causes the hypervisor to have to retry operations. And the bottom line is you see that as really bad performance. So if you want some fun and you have this type of hardware, dig out a Core 2 Duo Era machine, like a laptop, and I can give you a model. I had a Lenovo T60P, okay? Decent machine in its day. Install Windows Server 2008 on it, or even 2008 R2, pre-SP1. Then install your nice video card drivers. Do a control delete and count and see how long it takes for the screen to paint. That'll take about 5 seconds, when it should take like, you know, half a second. And that's because there's all these page faults as they try and get the data moved between the hypervisor and the video card. Microsoft addressed that specifically in Hyper-V and SP1. And the way they solve these problems is they take advantage of the SLAT feature, extended page tables, in the processors. And by doing that, they get this better performance. Well, it turns out for client-side Hyper-V, you have to have a processor that is SLAT capable. Now, here's the rub about this. It's really annoying. Intel and AMD have not done a great job of making it easy to find this information on their website. Right? Now, the good news, if you get a, I only know Intel specifically, but if Intel, their Sandy Bridge architecture, or later, you're fine. Those processors all have SLAT. Now, you go a little further back, it gets interesting. You start looking at the Nehalem architecture, and you start having to look in that general. Then it gets kind of weird. So the best thing to do is ask a manufacturer and say, does it have this? Okay. Now, the problem is you might have a bunch of machines already. You're wondering, well, do I have to waste a bunch of time trying to install this and find it doesn't work, Brian? No, you don't. Everybody's hero, Mark Rasanovich, and I hopefully didn't butcher his last name. I tend to do that. Has written a utility called CoreInfo. Is it raining? Wow. Gotta love Orlando. Okay, I'm going to download this. It's 339 KB. I'm going to save it down to my utilities folder. That is crazy rain, man. People watching the video are going to be like, what? We're going to edit that out. All right, I'm going to unzip this. It's a tiny little exe. Now, I'm going to start a command prompt, but you need to run as administrator. So I'll fire that up. And let's make my font kind of giant so we can see what I'm doing here. Aren't you guys glad you're in session with me? Thank you. Ooh, it got quiet all of a sudden. Ooh. All right, I'm being OCD here. Stop. Click OK. All right. Scary. Now, CoreInfo has a lot of stuff if you just run it after you agree to the license agreement. Okay, but we don't care. What we want to run is CoreInfo-V as in Victor. And what you want to see here is these items right here. Now, here's the frustrating thing. You got to watch what you're going on. If you look at the table, it says hypervisor, VMX, and EPT. Those are the three things we care about. Now, the first one says hypervisor. Yes, Hyper-V is enabled. It detects the hypervisor, and which means that it's going to be inaccurate presenting you with the other information because the hypervisor is in the way. Okay? But because the hypervisor is there, I know I'm okay. If you run a machine, though, that's, say, Windows 7 that you know can't run Hyper-V, or you run it on a machine that you've not enabled it on, that will come up as a dash. And that's the kind of weird thing here is, I thought Zoom it was turned on. I saw it. Let's double-click on it. There we go. So it has an asterisk. Now, these two items, if I were to run it on the machine without Hyper-V running, would have asterisks next to it if it was there. And what you care about is that you see EPT. Now, this tool also understands AMD and will put the AMD-specific term if you run it on an AMD machine. Okay? So Core Info is the only way I know for sure without having to install Hyper-V and trying it if I'm on an older processor and I just don't know. Now, the sad part is the machine doesn't have to be that old. I've got a Dell M6400 that I got just at the end of 2009, and it had been out for a little while that year. Okay, that's not that old, right? I'm sure many of you are on maybe a 3-year hardware update cycle, right? And you can have, I mean, I have 16 gig of RAM in it. It's a really nice machine. It runs Hyper-V great, but it will not run client Hyper-V because it does not have SLAT in the processor. And unfortunately, this is not something you can add on. It's something that's in the processor, and so you need to make sure you have the modern things. Okay. Yeah, you have to understand, some of you are like, big deal, it's raining and it's making noise. I'm from Southern California, so we don't get much rain. Okay, so I just showed you checking for support. Now, how do you set up your host? Well, configuring Hyper-V is really straightforward. Once you get the base OS installed. For Windows 8 client, it's in the add remote, remote? They must have thought I meant remote. No, add remove programs section. In the server manager, it's a role you add, all right? So let's go here. And we'll talk about BCD edit in just a second. So let's go over here to 4. So this is Windows 8 client. So I'm gonna come over here to the control panel. And if you go to the control panel and go to programs and features, turn features on or off, and then scroll down in here, and what you'll see is there's a node for Hyper-V. Now, you know there's two pieces. There's the Hyper-V platform and the Hyper-V management tools. So the management tools provide both the Hyper-V management console that we'll see in just a second, as well as the PowerShell commandlets, which is a new feature in Hyper-V that comes with Windows 8 in 2012. The Hyper-V management tools can be installed without the Hyper-V platform. The platform, though, is the core engine. You need both of those to have a good client experience. Once you do, you'll be able to come over here and start the Hyper-V manager. Now, the way you'll find that on Windows 8, you just start typing hyper. I know the whole start screen for some people freaks them out. It's just a giant version of your old start menu. You just start typing and you'll find it. And so when you have the Hyper-V manager, you can then come over here and we can start configuring virtual machines. Okay? Now, thunder is crazy. When you go to create a virtual machine, they have this wizard-based metaphor to help you navigate through it. But I want to talk about a couple other things before we go further. Now, let's go to the server here. And the way you get it in the server is you go to the server manager and you say add roles and features, run the wizard, role-based feature-based installation, pick your server, and then finally, you'll come down here and you'll see it's already installed on this machine. Oh, sorry. The zoom. It's right there. Hyper-V is installed. Okay? And once again, I get the same type of GUI experience here, and you'll see I've got a couple servers running, and I'll start another one while we're here. And then finally, if you are working with Server 2008, because, you know, not everybody gets to upgrade right away, plus we're still in beta, is you go to the server manager, go to roles, and you'll see I have Hyper-V installed, click add roles, next, and then there's Hyper-V on the list also. Okay? Now, in all cases, you will require a reboot, so be aware of that. And when you configure networking, if you're configuring networking on the network adapter you're connected on, you will lose network connectivity. So be aware of this if you're trying to configure a remote server to enable Hyper-V and you're trying to set up networking that is going to be using that same physical NIC. And I'll show you that configuration in just a minute. But understand that you will lose connectivity and you will have reboots. Oops. Okay, now if you're going to set up your guests, as a developer, you got to have MSDN. And if you're an IT pro, you should have TechNet. Because the benefit here is you're going to give access to all the Microsoft OS operating systems that you might want to try things on, and your license to use them in development and test. Now, there is one issue with this, product activation. And this is just flat out annoying, right? Because of the anti-piracy technology in the modern operating systems, you'll need at some point to activate. Now, there's a couple things that you need to keep in mind. Only activate it if you have to. In other words, you plan to keep the VM around longer than the trial period. For Windows 7 clients, that's 90 days. And for Windows servers, it's 240 days. And the way you get more time out of your VM is you run a command line called slmgr space dash rearm. And that will basically give you the effective time before you have to activate. This is particularly useful if you're just using the VM for a test. You're just going to throw it away. Why pay the hassle of activating? Now, if you do activate, here's the key thing you have to keep in mind. Windows product activation is taking information about your machine. And it's gathering things like the processor and the MAC address of your network card. In Hyper-V virtualization, most of your devices are emulated. In other words, I have NVIDIA GPUs on these physical machines. But inside my virtual machines, they see what you'll see, a Microsoft synthetic driver, a Microsoft synthetic video card. The network adapter is always a Microsoft fake video card. It's not an Intel-specific video card or network card that I have in my machines. And so what happens is those are consistent across the board. However, the network card does pick up the MAC address, and the MAC address will be dynamically generated by default based upon your host. So that's one piece of information that can change if I move a VM from one machine to another. And that can cause activation. But here's the bigger one. The processor, unlike everything else, is virtualized. That means when I go look at the processor inside the virtual machine, it sees the same physical processor on the host. Now, I've got three different machines here. Two of these are exactly the same. These are Lenovo W510s. And they have an Intel Extreme, blah, blah, blah on them. This, on the other hand, is a W520. So let's take a look at what we see here. So let's go over here to, we'll start with machine, what is that, machine 2? All right, so we'll start with machine 2, and I'm going to start up another VM here while that starts. And if we go look at the physical machine in properties, we'll see this is an Intel Core i7 CPU X920. So it's an Extreme 920. All right? And if we go to my virtual machine, first of all, let's bring up Task Manager. And Task Manager thinks I have 4 gig of RAM and that I have 4 processors. Okay? If we go to the properties for this computer, notice it sees the same machine. On the other hand, if I go to Device Manager, let's compare video cards. If we look at the host video card, right, I have an NVIDIA Quadra blah, blah, blah something. Right? You guys get the idea. This is probably, there we go, system information. I don't know. It's something. Okay, you can see it's NVIDIA. If we come over here and go to Display Adapters, because I'm running RemoteFX, we see a Microsoft RemoteFX graphics driver. Okay, so emulated drivers versus virtualized. The processor is always virtualized. The client sees the same processor type. Now, because of the hypervisor, the entire processor isn't necessarily available, right? Not necessarily all the APIC counters and things are available if you know how to do low-level programming. That's one of the compromises. But most of the core things of that processor are there, and there's enough of it there that Windows activation recognizes that that can be different. If we come over here to this machine, which I said, as I said, is a Lenovo W520. And if we go to this system, right, we see that this is an i7-2720QM CPU. Okay? So it's a different one. And if we go into the Windows 8 client, that is running on top of it. For whatever reason, it's not going full screen. Ooh, scary, scary. And we go over to system. Notice this sees the same processor, okay? So processors are virtualized, devices are emulated. Now, the problem with this also is that it installs drivers, it does configuration. If you try and join it to domain, there's identity information about that particular machine. And so what a lot of people want to do is they say, well, you know, I've done all this work, I want to make a copy of this VM. And because it's a set of files that can be copied and moved around between machines, people want to do that. So you need to get to know something called sysprep. And sysprep is what allows you to take an existing Windows machine and strip away the identity information that makes it a unique machine and put it back at what Microsoft calls the initial out-of-box experience, that pre-boot stage. And what will happen is it'll keep all your installed programs the way they are, but when it boots up, it'll allow you to change the name of the machine, allow you to create a new account, and allow you to join it to a domain safely so it'll be uniquely identified. Now, what's great about sysprep is that you can build one of your virtual machines, get Visual Studio installed, get some basic tooling, sysprep it, and activation won't start until you boot it up. So you can keep that around for a while. When you need a new one, bring it up and use it for dev and test. Right? So there's a lot of great flexibility there. And as you see, it's just one command line switch. You run it, you shut it down, and you're good to go. And we'll do that in just a bit. The other thing is keeping things up to date. Remember, your virtual machine is a machine. It has to be patched, Windows update, etc. So that's why with sysprep and doing some backups, you can save yourself a lot of time. Basically, every quarter, update your VM, update your master copy, sysprep it back, and save it off. Okay? Now, of course, I don't know about any specific final changes to licensing and activation of Windows 8. Particularly with Enterprise, they've got a new thing called Windows 8 to go that might be more flexible. Now, RAM, generally more RAM is better. But you want to optimize for the use case. The big mistake I see people do is they think, well, more RAM is better, so I'm going to give as much RAM as possible. But then that limits you to the number of VMs you can run it at the same time. And if you stagger your startup times, you'll find a lot of VMs will grab a bunch of RAM when they start up, but they won't necessarily need it all the time. The other thing is to watch services like SQL Server, which will say, hey, I'll use whatever you give me if you don't tell me not to. And just by making adjustments, you can get more out of a machine. So if we take a look here on my machine, we'll see we have this thing called dynamic memory in Hyper-V. So let's start with machine 3. Yes, this is the Windows 8 one. So if we come over here, if we bring up Task Manager, there we go. Go to More Details, go to Performance, and look at Memory. My physical memory of this host is about 16 gigs. And what we're seeing here is I've still got a bit of RAM available. Now, it's also showing things like page files, et cetera, but you see up there in the corner, 16 gigs of DDR3 RAM. Now, if you look at the VMs I'm running here, I've got a domain controller, an SQL server, a SharePoint front-end box, and I've also got a TFS box on the startup. And you'll notice what's happening here at the startup. We have this assigned memory, and we can go look at a particular machine and go to settings and see under memory, we can adjust how much RAM we want, set a minimum and a maximum amount of RAM. You can also go a lot further. There's things like buffers and memory weights. This is useful if you want to be able to have one virtual machine have RAM taken away because it's not using it and given to another virtual machine. For most people, especially for developers, the defaults work fine. It's all about finding that sweet spot for the number. For example, with the domain controller, you notice it's sitting at about 676. 512 is just a good start. I know it'll grab that much and be happy with it, but 768K is about the lowest on a Server 2008 R2 domain controller that you'll get away with, okay, even with a small domain. Really just wants that much RAM. Now, SQL Server, this puppy's a pig because one thing, I haven't done any adjustments on it. I've said, hey, you can have up to 4 gigs of RAM. It isn't even doing anything, and it's just like, I'm going to take those 2 gigs, and I'm ready. I want more. The minute I start doing some of the TFS, you'll see that pop up because it's hosting the databases for TFS. SharePoint, on the other hand, is interesting. Whoops, didn't want to connect. I wanted to look at its properties. I've said, you know what? I'm going to give you 2048, and I'm also going to cap you out at 4096. Now, what this means is I can run more virtualization, more VMs at a time, because typically as a single person, as a single developer, I'm not going to be making all those VMs hit their demand limit and try to push all that RAM. I still want to make sure I don't eat more than is available on the host. And typically when you're running the full GUI on the host, you want to leave yourself a gig buffer, right? So only allocate 15 gigs worth of VMs on your maximum amount of memory, okay? Now you see with TFS, I decided, well, I'll leave that at a fixed amount of memory. And that's set at the static one. Notice I can't change it because it's not available. Now the cool thing about dynamic memory is that, sure enough, it is available for you on Windows 8 client. So if we come over here to this virtual machine, I can enable dynamic memory there. Now you'll notice that there's this high-end option there that says, that is not the right machine. You guys are looking at the wrong thing. There we go. You'll see there's a minimum amount of RAM, and then the maximum RAM says, basically, unlimited. Give me as much as the hypervisor can allocate from other VMs and the host. Okay? So you can also do that, depending on what you're doing. But you know, I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he was running Server 2008 and didn't know there was even dynamic memory. Dynamic memory was one of those things that was added in SP1 of 2008 R2. So you always want to make sure you're current, because there's little wonderful gems they put in there. Now he can run four virtual machines when he used to only run two, right? Just because he's able to allocate a lot less. Now, the thing you got to watch out for is particular use cases, though. TFS, when you go to create a team project, that puts a lot of load on the app tier and the database tier. So you actually see it can actually allocate and need more RAM than it will normally sit in just doing basic operations. So you need to pay attention to those things. It's just knowing what you're doing. So don't over-allocate, but once again, don't under-allocate. All right. Talked about dynamic memory. Now, physical storage. This is probably the biggest one that people scrimp on, and this is what hoses you the most. Okay? First of all, RAM's super cheap. Believe it or not, folks, I put the 32 gigs of RAM in these laptops for about $300. 32 gigs of RAM in a laptop. That's sweet, right? Now, of course, when it costs you $1,600 or, you know, $2,000 as much as a laptop, you're not going to do it. So it's that price point. Find that sweet spot. Physical storage, though, for some reason, people just can't seem to get over that this is going to be the major bottleneck for your virtual machines. Right? So we think about storage, if you can at all, use SSDs. I'm using all SSDs here, and then try and get the SSD that's optimized for your bus. So in these two machines, the W510s, they only support SATA 2, which means 3 gigabit is the maximum throughput that it can push across the bus. Okay, and that applies to the internal bays as well as to the eSATA port on this. The W520, on the other hand, supports SATA 3 on the internal drives. And those internal drives will do 6 gigabit. Now, what does that mean for performance numbers? Well, I did some speed tests with a program called HDTune. So let's go over here to number 3. And I took some screenshots. Now, unfortunately, I think I put the screenshots in a wrong place so I get to actually show off a feature that I wasn't going to show right away. But hey, that's going to work out fun. Okay, so on this machine, I told you I was using something called BootaVHD. More on that in a bit. So if we go over here to this internal drive, in the BootaVHD folder, you'll see this file called w520am.vhd. If you don't know what VHDs are, they're virtual hard drives. It's a giant file that Windows will see as a hard drive. The cool thing in 2012 server and in Windows 8 is you now can just right-click and mount them. In Windows 7 and 2008 R2, you have to either use the command line, like disk part, and attach the vDesk, or you can do it through the computer management console. So what I did is I just mounted that, and so now if I go to users, administrators, my pictures, and they're not in pictures, they're in my documents. There we go. So I did a bunch of tests here, and I just want to show you a couple things. So this is a Crucial M4 drive. It's SATA 3. I tested it over eSATA via a black connection cable. The cable means something to me, but the point is. And notice the throughput, right? Only 131 megabytes per second, okay? Now, this is megabytes, not megabits, so you could have to multiply by 8 and you can get the throughput level. Okay, that's pretty good, right? Especially if you compare that to a mechanical drive. Now, let's compare that, though, to when it's in the ultra bay. 461 is my minimum. Almost four times. The right hard drive with the right bus is money, but don't overpay, because I've got that same drive in one of these W510s, and I'm maxed out at the throughput. I'm actually getting over, I have another picture if you care to see it, but about 220. So I'm getting just over half, okay? So if you're gonna buy SSDs and put your money where your mouth is, then what you wanna do is make sure you're matching it to the right level of the hardware. So there is a significant difference. What does this mean? The faster they can get data off that drive, the faster it gets loaded to memory, the faster your virtual machine's gonna boot. And when time is money, it's crazy. Joel Spolsky did a blog post. Every developer should have an SSD. The time you'll save on compiling and doing other things, and now you throw a virtual machine in, is just worth every penny. And these days, you can get these Crucial drives. They're on sale at Amazon for 256 gig drives, and they were selling them for, they did a special for like $289. Crazy, crazy prices, okay? Now, you can't afford SSDs, or you don't trust them, don't believe them, you start looking at the hybrid drives. Seagate makes these Momentus hybrid drives that have extra cache on them and still mechanical. And the benefit of them is you can get them in 750 gigs, so you get that extra space, but you're going to see better performance. Not as good as the SSDs, but better. The other thing is mechanical drives. Now, I've got some mechanical drives, and this is where we start talking about the interface. So I've got right here, this is a 2 terabyte external Seagate drive. And it's using the hybrid technology. The key is that it uses USB 3. So on copy operations, where I'm reading from this drive and copying across the SSD, I've gotten throughput as fast as 100 megabytes a second. Okay? That's from a mechanical drive. That's really good. The interface can make the difference. Here's the crazy thing. Even on a USB 2, you'll see better throughput for this because it put a little extra data off the drive. Okay? eSATA. What I like about eSATA is eSATA is optimized for drive I/O, whereas USB is more flexible. It's multi-protocol and things. With the eSATA cables, you can get these in cases, or this is what's called eSATA P. So this allows me to plug this in to the machine, and because I have a hybrid port, which has a USB port in it as well, so let's actually go over here, back to machine 3, and we'll go to the desktop, and we'll pop this puppy in. And you'll note there's little power lights there. It's getting power from the USB port, and we'll give it a second. And now we should see, there you go, I have a Gen 3 drive available that I can use. Okay? Now, what brands? I'm a big fan of Intel. Intel does not make the fastest ones out there if you look, and they charge a premium, but knock on wood, I've had the best reliability. SSD drives do fail. I had a Crucial drive fail at me, a TechEd, back in 2010, and I lost all my VMs the night before. Good thing I had a backup. But yeah, they do fail, and they fail. Unfortunately, they don't TikTok, they don't warn you, they don't say anything nice, they just go boom. So backups, I carry lots of mechanical backups for space, but I'm addicted to speed. I gotta have it, okay? So if you have more drive questions, let me know. I mean, some people swear by different brands, OCZ or OCZ, make some smoking fast drives, they even make these hybrid controllers. For developers, getting yourself SSDs and then a big drive on the side is going to give you the best experience possible for moving these things around. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, I'm able to start up VMs and get them going fairly quickly here, and the SSDs are what are making that happen. You can actually have a slower processor and even less RAM, and the SSD will give you a better experience. Now, there is the ability to have network-based storage. iSCSI is the cheapest way to do it. Company named QNAP, for example, is great. They have these network devices. They'll sell them without drives, so you can provide your own drives. Pop it into a gigabit network. You leave the VHDs on the network, and you can boot them and connect them across the wire. So it gives you flexibility to do things like cluster migrations. Obviously, production SANs, you know, that's a whole other, that's where IT pros get involved. The key thing I'd watch out for them is that, remember that when you have a virtual machine, it's got this virtual hard drive, which we're going to talk about in more detail in a second. And that virtual hard drive is doing I/O. And if it's doing I/O, right, there's contention for a resource. And one of the mistakes I see in SAN environments, especially for developers who get shoved into it, right, they take away your machine and they say, we're going to put you on the SAN and we're going to give you a VM, is that they put too many VMs on the same LUN, or the logical unit, on the SAN. And so there's contention for those resources. So you really got to look at the number of VMs that are running on the same thing, particularly for developers, because we're I/O intensive, compiling, doing all the things we do are I/O intensive. So we want to watch that. Now, there it is. Now, virtual storage, VHDs, virtual hard disks. You've been seeing them kind of floating around as I've been doing things. There's two formats, VHD and VHDX. VHD is limited to 2 terabytes and is the current version, so Windows Server 2008 R2 and before. It's also compatible with virtual PC, etc. VHDX is new for Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. Better resiliency, and look at 64 terabyte virtual drives. Sweet! These drives, when you define them, you can say I want to be dynamically allocated, which means I want to grow as I put data into it, which is great for disk space, but not so great for performance, because as you're doing things, it's going to have to allocate more disk space. Okay? You can also do fixed, which will give you better performance at the cost of pre-allocation and all that storage as you move around. Okay? We also have a feature called differencing disks and snapshots. And the idea behind them is that we will do all of our writes to a secondary VHD. We'll do our reads in a combination from the original drive and the secondary drive. And this allows us to have the ability to do undos and throw things away. It allows us to take a base image and create different implementations. Let's say you have to evaluate a third-party control. So you're looking at, say, oh, Telerik's a good brand, and say DevExpress. They both make great stuff. So you're like, I want to try these out, but I want them to be isolated. I don't want to put them together. I want to just see how they work on their own. So you can create a VM on Windows 7, get Visual Studio installed. Then you create 2 diff drives, one for Telerik and one for DevExpress. Point them to the same base. So you boot up one, play with it, install their stuff, shut it down, switch the hard drive, try the other one. Really great stuff. And then snapshots, we'll be looking at that. I've got a bunch here to play with. Okay, hard disk performance I actually showed you already, so we're just going to move on along to that. Okay, this is probably one of my favorite things that people just don't do enough of, boot to VHD. So what is it? So you've got these computers. They have a hard drive. And so you pop out your, well, who uses media anymore, really? It's your USB stick, right, or even boot off the network. And you lay down an operating system, and it takes up the hard drive. And then you're saying, God, I really want to install this beta. Oh, man, but you know, I can't get another hard drive from a machine. You know, desktops, it's a pain in the butt to install a new drive. Even the laptops, they keep making it harder for you to swap out the hard drive. That's what I used to do all the time before virtualization. I cared about a bunch of extra hard drives. With boot to VHD, here's what you get to do. You get to build a what appears to be a VM. Right? You put the OS into the VHD. The difference is you do some magic with a tool called BCDEdit and BCDBoot. And what it basically does is that this low-level bootloader that gets laid down on the physical hard drive, and when the OS starts up, it gives you the menu selector just like you get when you have multiple OS installed on the hard drive. The difference is you've got your OS all isolated inside a VHD. And what happens is you can then boot between them. The great thing is that's the only thing that's virtualized. That's the only virtualization in place is this little bit of bootloader magic. Right? You are running through a special virtual driver, and I'll show you that in a second through Device Manager. But what it means is you now have access to all the real hardware to the point that I'm running each of these machines as boot to VHD, yet they're all running Hyper-V. There's only this little bit of magic in between at the boot startup point where it basically redirects and says, load the OS from this VHD. Okay? Now, let's go over here to Windows 8, or how about let's go over to this one. We'll go about this one, the one in the middle. Okay? So first of all, let's run msconfig, system configuration. And if you run this on a normal machine, usually you'll say normal startup. And if you go to boot, you'll have one thing in the list, okay? Now, mine has 3, though. It has Windows Server 2012, release candidate, and then you see Windows and Windows. It turns out I do not have any OS installed on the native hard drive. All my operating systems are coming from VHD files. Now, this provides a nice GUI that lets you set the default as well as the ability to delete, okay? But if you really want to get into configuration, you need to know 2 command line tools, BCDEdit and BCDBoot. Okay. Now, too many different fonts here, sorry. Okay. If I do BCDEdit and don't do anything, it's going to enumerate the list of items that I have configured. Now, there's lots of things with GUIDs and there's lots of crazy curly braces, but we're developers, we don't care. And you'll notice that if we come down here, there's the Windows Boot Manager that describes the basic things. And notice one thing here, partition. What's my main boot drive? Which one do they think I should be looking for things on initially? Then you'll notice that there's this thing called display order. And there's current, and then there's these two crazy GUIDs, right? You notice they're just barely different by a couple digits. Then you come down a little further, and you see Windows Server 2012 release candidate, right? And you'll notice it has its GUID information, and notice it says it's identified as current. Well, if we go down a little further, we see Windows W520 Management Server 2008 R2, and notice the identifier. And notice this device, VHD equals. Okay? Well, what's going on there? Well, what happened is I set up these VHDs as a boot option. Now, you'll see information on how to set this on the web, and I'm going to show you some of the command lines that you use. But basically, you tell it, hey, use this VHD. Here's where it lives. Now, a lot of people put the path, and that's fine if you know that it's only got one physical drive in your system. But I have UltraBase here, so I always have at least two, and when I plug in the eSATA, I can even do three bootable drives. Okay? The problem is, drive letters sometimes shift, and that's just happenstance of the BIOS sometimes. You can't always control it. If you use this little magic locate, and as long as you don't have a duplicate folder with a duplicate file name in it, it'll find it automatically. It'll cost you, you know, a couple milliseconds in boot time. But this way, you don't have to even worry about what drive letter, you just have to know where you put it. Okay? And then I keep mine in a folder called BootVHD. So if we look on this machine and go over to My D drive. See, this is the fun part. It's my E drive. And notice I've labeled it INT01. That's the physical drive. And we look at boot to VHD. I've got W520AM, W520AMER, okay? And then I have server 2012. Now, you know something interesting about this. These ones are 15 and 14 gigs, and this one's 41. These are all dynamic VHDs. But what happens is when you boot up a boot to VHD environment, it expands to the limit of the drive. Well, what do you mean, Brian? Well, it turns out that when you go and create a virtual hard drive, so you can say, for example, new hard disk, you have the ability to specify what type, more importantly, the size. If you pick dynamic, you can specify how big you want it to be, okay? You notice it defaults to 127 gigs. Now, you got to be careful there, because even if you make it dynamic, when you use boot to VHD, it's going to jump out, okay? Now, if you're not very, OCD or retentive, it's better to make them fixed. That way you know you've got the disk space allocated. If you pay attention to this stuff and you're really geeky about it, you can save yourself some disk space. Just keep your little calculator, your little grid in Excel to say, okay, I've got this much space I got to keep as a buffer. Then it'll be good to go, okay? And that's what I'm doing here. What happens, Brian, if I run out of disk space and I try and boot? What's our favorite color, folks? It's blue. Right? You'll blue screen. Okay? That tends to freak people out. So if you're a freak out kind of person, fixed is a lot better. That'll save you some pain and suffering. All right? So with boot to VHD, it's not that hard. Now, here's the cool thing about it. You want to try this, how easy this is at home? It's great. If you go up to Microsoft, and you say, I would like, I typed Google, and so it's not going to let me go out to the internet. There we go. Say, Windows Server 2012 RC VHD download. You can come over here to this site, and once you register, there's an option to download a VHD. That means you can run the VHD as a virtual machine. But what if you want to try Hyper-V out? Well, you have to run that on a real machine. That's what I did. You download the VHD. You extract it. And you'll end up with it in some folder. And I've got a copy of one here. Let's see if we go to my D drive. Eval VHD. This is actually a 2008 R2, but it's the same. You'll see a hard drive there, right? And all you have to do is you mount this up. Now, you might say, Brian, I'm not running Windows 8. I don't get that nice mount command. Okay, fine. Run the comp. Whoa, come back here. Comp mgmt.msc snap-in. Go to the disk management tools. And this is available in Windows 7 and 2008 R2 as well. Right-click, attach the VHD. So you go out to that drive. Navigate to the VHD, and you mount that puppy up. Now, here's the key. If you're going to do this little trick, make sure you don't already have an entry for whatever this is going to be. So I always make sure I change my entries to something custom. For Windows 7, it's always going to say Windows 7 is going to be the default boot entry. Okay? For Server 2008, it does Windows Server 2008 and then R2 or whatever. Once you do that, you got to find the drive letter they assigned. So if we look on here, local disk H is that attached drive. I want to be able to boot this. Now let me run msconfig. And so if we look at my boot list, I have Windows 8, Windows Server 2012, Windows 7 OEM, and something else. Now, when I go to run this, all I have to do is go to my Windows drive, go to System32, and type bcd boot h windows. Now, when I do this, they will update the bootloader to say, hey, there's this VHD out there with Windows. We're going to boot into it. Now, once I do this, check this out. There's a couple things that are going to happen. It's going to do that. If I go back and run msconfig again, whoops, there you go. You notice now I have a new entry, Windows Server 2008 R2, H Windows. It's done all the work for me. Now, if you want to do it manually, and I'll post these commands on my blog or you can search, but the point is, if you go and look at the command line switches for BCD edit, you'll see that there are a bunch of cool commands that let you do it all from the command line. Let's get a little bigger for you. Okay, let's talk about these commands. Really straightforward. Copy. This lets you copy an existing entry so that you can then make a new custom entry. This is where you get started if you don't want to do BCD boot. You want to get rid of one? Use delete. You want to change the description? Slash set the GUID description. You want to set up a new VHD? You do one of the copy operations, either the default or the current, and then set two things. One is device and one is OS device. Specify the path, use the magic locate, and you're good. And if you don't like the display order, you can use that switch, replace what's in curly brackets with a GUID, and that'll move it to the top. There's also a move last. And these are just little commands you can do to make, you know, once again, your little OCD, that's me, to rearrange it. Now, I don't want to keep this here, so I'm going to delete it. And what I'm going to do first is I'm going to fix this and make this back my default, and then I'll delete that one. Now, one more thing I'm going to tell you about. If you're going to put Windows 8 down, Windows 8 has a new graphical bootloader, and it's kind of cool because it's, you know, lets you do all sorts of things. It works on touch and things. But if you're doing it mostly to test, it's annoying because it's a lot slower, and maybe you're only going to use Windows 8 at night, but most of the time during the day you're going to use Windows 7. Make Windows 7 your default. It'll use the old crappy graphic command line text version of the loader, but it boots a lot faster, right? Because they don't have to load a bunch of the Windows 8 preload to get things going. Otherwise, they load a bunch of the Windows 8 preload. Then when you pick Windows 8 starts like right then. I mean, it's there, but you've paid the overhead if you really want to go to Windows 7, because then it goes back and does a reboot and goes back in. Okay, now when I click this, anytime you make any changes with system configuration, it's going to say you want to restart. I'm going to say no. You should, but you don't have to. Okay, you can live a happy lifestyle. All right. So boot to VHD. Good stuff. I just demoed that. Okay, video cards in general don't have a huge impact in the sense that you've got an emulated card in there. It's always been one of the, you know, Achilles heels of virtual machines. However, if you look into something called RemoteFX, which I showed you earlier, I showed you that high-def video playing in a virtual machine, life gets much better. Remember, VIR 313, the session before we talked about all the new stuff. The bottom line is they have technology that will use the hardware GPU to make the VM run better. And that makes Visual Studio run better, lets you do videos, DirectX, et cetera. The biggest downside to this is that you have to run the server OS, okay? And so that means 2008 R2 SP1 or Server 2012. And there is a specialized licensing component that's a part of Windows Remote Desktop Services. To do Remote FX, to try it, you need to install Remote Desktop Services Virtualization Host. That's the option to check. Okay, and when you do that, it runs for 120 days before it needs a licensing server. After 120 days, RemoteFX will stop working. Okay? Now, if you have RemoteFX available, like I do on this machine, the way you know is that you're able to go to your virtual machines, and when you go to Customize and go to the Settings, RemoteFX is there on 2008 R2 SP1 under Add Hardware. Once it decides to wake up, you'll see an option for Remote FX Video Adapter. And then you'll be able to set it up here, and you can control the number of monitors and the resolution. The number of monitors and resolutions you can give a virtual machine is all based upon the amount of video RAM and the horsepower of your video card. Okay? So you can't run, you know, 40 VDI clients all with Remote FX on a typical video card. You'll need multiple cards. Now, on 2008 R2, excuse me, on Server 2012, you see Remote FX under physical GPUs, and you can specify which ones are available, okay? And then the same thing, you go and add the device to the virtual machine. Now, one thing to be aware of in the new world here, oh, I didn't add it in. Sorry, I can't show you. Is that I can run RemoteFX on these W510s, which have DirectX 10X era hardware. I cannot run Server 2012. They have now bumped the requirements of that you have to have DirectX 11 compatible hardware to do RemoteFX on Server 2012. So keep that in mind if you're going to consider that technology. Okay? But once again, if you're doing things like games and stuff, you can do a lot more in VMs that you didn't think before. That said, if it's only you that you're concerned about, it's not worth the overhead, right? Just use Boot to VHD if you want to play around. It's when you get stuck in a VDI environment where they make developers run in VMs that you want RemoteFX. Okay, the rest of the stuff I have to talk about is more functional as tips on things. So first of all, sysprep is your friend. You might be thinking, well, Brian, I'm afraid. Don't be afraid. It's not that scary. You sure about that? Yes, I promise. All right. How are we going to do this? Well, let's go over here to machine 4. And let's go find one of my machines here. Let's see, I need a hard drive. So let's go out here. And let me unmount this drive. So just right-click Detach VHD. Is that the right one? No, that's Windows 8. That's probably not good. I don't want to try and detach the one I'm running on. There you go. Okay. So now if we come over here, let's create a new VM. So let's say File, New, Virtual Machine. Now they give you this startup page that tells you a bunch of stuff, and we don't care. The first thing is, what do you want to call it? Okay? Demo VM. Now where do you want to store it? By default, it wants to put it on your C drive. Who stores their stuff on their C drive? Change this. You don't want this to be here. Now I'm going to put it on my fast SSD. And we'll put it down in temp. And what it'll do is it'll take the name you apply here and create a subfolder automatically. Okay? Next, startup RAM. Set this to what you want, but obviously you can change it later. You can also say, I want to use dynamic memory. Okay? And we'll do this and say 1024. Next. Now, network adapters. Oh boy, this is interesting. So if you'll notice here, I've got three different network adapters. When you create a network adapter for use by Hyper-V, it basically installs a virtual network into the host machine and does some magic where it maps different services to the virtual NIC and only the Hyper-V virtual switch to the real NIC. Now, you can share your physical NIC with Hyper-V. Obviously, for better performance, you would like to have a dedicated NIC for your virtual machines, at least one, and your own NIC for your host. Now, this is getting easier. A lot of the new Intel motherboards, for example, the more higher-end ones, come with two NICs out of the box. And even with laptops, with your Wi-Fi and your built-in NIC, you can do that. Something to consider. Laptop, I've only got one physical NIC, so I'm sharing the hardwire with Hyper-V. But I've also set up my Wi-Fi, which is a new feature in Windows 8. You can use Wi-Fi for your virtual machines. And you can also create private networks where only VMs can see each other, or a shared private where the host can talk to the VMs, and they can talk to each other, but you can't talk to the rest of the network. So you have lots of flexibility. And in 2012, they have a pluggable network switch that supports Cisco plugins, all sorts of stuff. You can do crazy stuff, create completely virtual domains that are isolated. Now, the next thing is a virtual hard drive. You can pick the hard drive and create it right here on your own, Or you can use an existing drive, or you can attach it later. I've got an existing drive, so we'll go use that eval drive that I've got over here. So let's go find that. And we'll pick that. Okay. Next, finish. Now I always like to go look at the settings while I'm doing this. Okay, virtual processor is one of the things they don't set. I've got 8, so I can just pop this up and look kind of crazy, but we'll go with something like 4. Hard drive is set up. Now you notice there's IDE controllers and SCSI controllers. The big difference between them is your boot drive always has to be IDE. With SCSI, you can do hot, add, and remove, and I'm going to show you a trick with that in just a moment. But the bottom line is you need to have at least one that's there. You can have a DVD drive for mounting ISOs and all that good stuff, or use the host drive. And there's our RAM. So let's get this started. And when I start it, I'm going to use something called VM Connect. VM Connect is a specialized remote client that talks directly to a Hyper-V. So Hyper-V has what's called the VM bus. And the VM bus is what allows the physical devices to be communicated with by the virtual devices. And they basically, do you see how fast that booted? That was freaking awesome, wasn't it? I'm telling you, SSDs, baby. Let's see, is it this? Nope, how about, hold on. It's only as fast when you know the password, right? Let's see. What's the one Microsoft Pat PASSWORD1? There it is. Woohoo! Okay, give this a second. Now, VM Connect, because it talks to the VM bus, you can always connect it even if you don't have a network connection. So this is your gateway to always get into your VM. The downside is VM Connect is something you run from the host machine. Once you get your VM set up, and if you can enable them on the network, then you can just use standard RDP to connect. And that gives you greater flexibility with things like clipboard passing data, mounting virtual drives for within the RDP client, et cetera. Now, while that's running, the username or password is incorrect. Uh-oh. Anybody know what the Microsoft default password is for the eval VM? Oh, wait. There was a Word file that actually told me. It's always something messed up. They're never consistent. Is there? There's no password in here. P-A password. Nice. They didn't give me the password. Okay, well, you saw it booted really fast. Okay, well, I have a backup over here, so we will go over to the Windows 7 VM, and I'll show you sysprep from here. So here's what you do. To do sysprep, you simply fire up an administrative command prompt. Change to the sysprep folder underneath Windows System 32. Type sysprep. And it brings up a GUI here. What you want to do is check generalize and shut down. Okay? It's going to run for a little bit. And it's going to shut down. At that point, you want to take that VHD and back it up. Because the next time you boot, it's going to think it's a new installation of Windows. It's going to ask you for a new machine name. And it's going to ask you to create a default user account. The administrator account, if you had it enabled, will become disabled, but will still be there. We'll have the password you last used with it. If you had any other local accounts there, they'll still be there, but they'll be disabled. So what's weird is, I usually boot up and create an installer account. So what happens when I reboot from sysprep, I then have to create an account like dev or temp or whatever. Get in the system. It makes me a local administrator. Then I switch out and delete the accounts. Okay? It's not very sexy. Literally, I do this. It's going to flash for a bit, and it's going to shut down. That's it. Now, this is the basics. There's all sorts of magic out there with sysprep, right? You talk to the IT pros. They can do all sorts of voodoo. You can embed your keys to auto-activate. You can do all sorts of great stuff. The bottom line is Visual Studio is very happy with sysprep. The modern versions of SQL Server are happy. You can't sysprep if you have TFS installed. You can't sysprep if you have SharePoint installed. But for a core developer, you can install your core tools and have them available for you if you want. You can install the remote debugging tools, all that stuff, no problem with sysprep. And what you do is you then back up these sysprep virtual machines, and then you can just go to your library when you need them. Now, snapshots, are a way to have undo for your virtual machine. Basically, to go back in time when something bad happens. Now, a couple things to be aware about snapshots. Number one, you're limited to 50 per VM. Trust me, you get a 50 snapshots, you're probably going to lose your mind. You're also going to pay a performance penalty, particularly if those are stacked in a list. They eat a lot of disk space. Now, a couple things about snapshots is that they capture both data and configuration changes. All right. So if we take a look at machine 3 here, oops, wrong, machine 4, and you'll see that inside my VM here for Keller VM, I have two undos. One has internal time sync off. One has hardware time sync on. And you see now is telling you which is your current instance. If we go take a look at what's going on here by looking at settings, we can see that my snapshots are being stored as what are called AVHD files, and they're being stored right here under my D drive. So if we go out to my D drive, go look in that VM, you'll see I've got these folders with configuration data, and then did they move my VHDs? They did. There we go. And then there's the AVHDs. So the snapshot folder had the configuration, and there's the AVHDs. These are the temporary drives that are taking all the writes when I run that particular configuration. You got to watch your disk space on these because they will grow. Now, what's cool about snapshotted VMs is if you export it, and this is how you move it to a new machine, it will copy the entire configuration as well as all the snapshots. Sometimes, though, you just want a particular configuration. Well, guess what? You can right-click on a particular config and select export. And it's going to export the VM up to that particular snapshot parent, so you don't have to take all the snapshots with you. Now, the other big thing that I've got a tip on here is deleting snapshots. So if you look at the snapshot tree here, you notice I've got undo, end of workshop, before. Well, here's something nasty that happens when you go to delete the VM. You're done with it. You're tired. I want to get rid of it. I need the disk space. So you come over here to the top of the VM, and you're going to select delete. Well, when you go to do that, you know what it tries to do? It takes all the snapshots and it merges them in order to the main VHD parent because they don't want to get rid of your data. They think you might want it. You can take hours. I was talking to a buddy who said, yeah, this thing ran all night, right? And all he did was then delete it once he was done. So the tip is this. There's twofold. One is you notice I have this root one called undo. I typically just say right-click and apply undo. And then delete the snapshot chain and then delete the VM. And because the undo didn't have a lot of work, it's good to go. On the other hand, if you did a bunch of work on that first root one and you know it'll merge for a while, just start at the bottom and start deleting your snapshots. And it'll go through and delete them very quickly without merging, and then you can delete the parent. Okay, and I have that on the slide up here. Okay, that's that whole thing there. So there's two strategies. Either have an undo snapshot at the root or have it at the bottom. Now, when using boot to VHD, use fixed drives unless you're going to be careful. Right, as I said, they always expand to the maximum size. So if you're using dynamic, watch how big they are. One thing about using virtual machines is that they're not good for everything these days. And right now, the biggest thing is the Windows Phone tools, some profilers, and any programs that require direct access to hardware. Thumbdrive.vhd, when you have data you need to move into a VM and you don't have good network connectivity, you know how you know you plug in a USB stick onto your machine? Just use a VHD. Create it. You can mount it on your host, put files into it, and then you go to the SCSI adapter, and you just mount it up. Really straightforward. It's great for installs, source files, etc. Optimize your dynamic VHDs. There's a compact tool in the console tools. You just select Edit VHD, Compact, and it will squish things down. The one thing to watch out for, though, is if you've had a large amount of data that you deleted, that doesn't get picked up, so it's only going to squish out from the tail. So if you go to get sdelete from sysinternals, it has a zero out feature that will write zeros to all the free space. Then you can compact, you'll gain data back. For example, I had a 30 gig file, then when I did that, I gained back 14 gigs worth of empty space because I deleted a bunch of stuff. Okay? So if you're gonna use dynamic disks, you gotta monitor them. Okay? Automation, last thing I wanna talk about is in Hyper-V, there's a WMI interface that's available in 2008, 2008 R2. Started with System Center Virtual Machine Manager, they added PowerShell commandlets on top of it to make it easier. And finally, with Hyper-V on Server 2012 and Windows 8, we have PowerShell commandlets in the box. There's over 100 and some odd commandlets available to you. Let me just show you one I have that's really straightforward. If we go over here to 4, go to my desktop, fire up Visual Notepad. So here's a little PowerShell script. And you'll see it just goes through, hooks up to the system and says, okay, where are the arguments? Get a hold of the virtualization namespace. Get a hold of the export object, called, or the VMS object called the export system, and write it out to disk. And it goes through and provides status information as it does it through a command prompt. And then I wrote a little command file on top of that because I'm not a real good smart PowerShell person. And I was able to go through and just export my whole set of VMs from a script, and I could go walk away. You can start VMs, you can create VMs, you can do snapshots, you can just about do anything you want. If you prefer C Sharp, you can program the WMI interface and do that, and do just about anything you want. Sorry, I went over a little, but thank you for coming. Virtualization is really great. The key things you have to take away is just spend a little time monitoring what you're doing. Look at your virtual hard drives. Look at your hardware and really consider SSDs is probably the biggest tip of all, is that I/O is what really kills you. And take a look at SysPrep. Save a few copies. Save yourself some time. Automate and use virtualization. Thank you very much. Have a great one.